and thank you for listening to the Skeptics in the Pub online podcast. This unedited audio is taken from God and Extraterrestrial Intelligence, The Future of Human Religion, by Dr. Erin Adair. It was first broadcast live on Thursday, 27th of June, 2024. A video of this, and many of the recordings hosted by Skeptics in the Pub online, are still available on our YouTube channel. We hope you enjoy this podcast, and if you would like to support what we do, you can join our Patreon. Find us at Patreon, Skeptics in the Pub online.
Thank you. Thank you for the very warm invitation and the wonderful introduction. Now to let everyone down. But nonetheless, thank you all for coming. And the talk I have prepared is primarily based on the book I wrote with my friend and co-author, Jonathan M.S. Pierce, who's a Englishman. So the UK people, I would recommend you also find a reason to bother him. He's available for good chats. And the book we have on aliens and religion is the backbone for what we'll be discussing here. The idea that one day in the not too distant future, we might finally show for certain that we are not alone in the universe and that we have other intelligent people that we can reach out to. We actually already have some future documentation that we should expect our visitation in just a little less than 40 years, according to the sacred document that is Star Trek. Of course, we generally think about aliens and interactions with aliens as something part of modern science fiction. And yes, indeed, that is part and parcel for a lot of books, movies, TV series, and that. But the idea of thinking about the existence of aliens goes way, way back. For example, in the 3rd century BC, we have the famous philosopher Epicurus already thinking about the ideas of the infinity of worlds and having just so many opportunities that eventually some of them are going to develop plants and animals and perhaps even people. So we have just this little excerpt saved for us from this one philosopher and indicating, yeah, the ancients had this conception. And nowadays we are trying to see if these ideas are right. In a sense, we are catching up with these ancients thanks to the Copernican Revolution. As you know, Nicholas Copernicus writes this famous book arguing that not the Earth, but the Sun is the center of the universe, and the Earth actually revolves around the Sun. And this has had a few repercussions in the history of science and ideas. The extensions of this we are still encountering, and in particular in this depiction here, comes from the first English-speaking Copernican, Thomas Digges, where he has the idea of Copernicus with the Sun at the center, but also that the stars are not just a solid dome around the orbit of the Earth, but it's actually something that extends into infinity. And so the first ideas in modern Europe of the idea that there could be an infinite universe with infinite stars and potentially all of those stars having planets, this made our universe so much larger than the more antique traditions. And we now realize that not only is the Earth not the center of the universe, but our sun is not the center of the universe. Our sun is in another galaxy, which is one of hundreds of billions of a universe of such extent that we can't even be sure it's finite in size. We ultimately, from the Copernican Revolution, realize that we are not in a special location. And so there's a general thing that we can speak of as the Copernican principle. Unless you have evidence otherwise, you should expect yourself to be average. We are on more likely an average world than an exceptional world, unless you have some sort of evidence to that extent. And so we apply this Copernican principle even more broadly, not making ourselves special, but understanding ourselves as part of a population aware we're pretty much on average, we're the C students of the universe, you could say. Now, this universe was not the one originally thought of by both ancient philosophers, early scientists, early religious folks. And one might wonder, is this the sort of universe that we might expect on one created by the Almighty and including fellow alien brethren? So you might hear, for example, the idea that the universe is fine-tuned for life. But imagine three different possible universes. One where life exists on every single possible body that you can look at, every planet, every asteroid, Every sort of conceivable body that life could exist, it does exist. And if you were to say that the universe is fine-tuned for life, maybe that's what you'd expect. How about on another universe where only on Earth are the conditions just right for life, that the conditions are just so specialized that it only happens once in the entirety of all of existence? This is kind of an extreme version of the rare Earth or Goldilocks principle, that everything is just right, and it is beyond chance that we would actually be here. It almost requires supernatural intervention for us to be here. Lastly, a universe where life is rare, but because there are just enough chances that eventually it pops up here and there across the galaxy or across the observable universe. Which one of these is actually expected on theism? Because the interesting thing is you look at different religious arguments and they would argue for universe one, universe two, or universe three. Basically, all of them are consistent with, and none of them are consistent with, theistic ideas. We really cannot determine that from religious argumentation. You will get every answer and none. Science is going to be much more likely to answer the question of, are we alone in the universe? And if we are populated in this universe with other folks, where are they? In fact, that was the question blurted out by the famous Italian physicist Enrico Fermi when discussing the UFO phenomenon at that time and thinking, hey, if we think that the universe is abundantly filled with life and the aliens have been around for millions of years, why aren't they here? Why isn't it obvious that they are here? And so this has led to the Fermi paradox. How do we reconcile the idea that there are plenty of opportunities and plenty of time for life to exist and gallivant around the galaxy, and yet we don't have definitive evidence that they're here? Are the aliens just lazy and they never leave their solar system? Are they hiding in some sort of prime directive like from Star Trek where they try not to interfere with a developing civilization? Or are their motives more nefarious, such as in the Dark Forest hypothesis, that they are basically hiding on purpose and anyone who dares make a noise gets destroyed before they become a threat? Is it the case that civilizations just have a sort of self-destructive mechanism built in, so they reach a certain level of advancement and then destroy themselves with nuclear war, AI, or just way too many YouTube videos? This is a hypothesis out there, maybe less because of the YouTube, but nonetheless, is there some sort of filter on those civilizations? Or is it the case that life is just tremendously rare that we should not expect to find anyone else out there? The question of is anyone out there is also somewhat mathematically treated by the famous Drake equation. This was a simple hand-wavy sort of collection of variables where you don't necessarily know the particular values, but if you could make reasonable guesses for them and multiply them together, you would get the present number of civilizations in the Milky Way galaxy as we speak. Some of these factors we actually know pretty well, such as what is the rate of star formation. Some of these we've only figured out somewhat recently, such as how many stars out there have planets and what fraction of them seem to be potentially habitable. Other factors we just don't really have a good grip on at all, such as what fraction of habitable worlds develop life, what fraction of those develop intelligence, what fraction of those become intelligent worlds that can talk across all of space with radio technology, and how long do these civilizations actually last? A lot of these we really don't know, and many people will put in various estimates or various honest guesses for what these values are and get widely different numbers for that number of civilizations currently in the Milky Way. In the book that Jonathan and I wrote together, we tried actually incorporating our uncertainty in these values and putting in probability distributions that best reflect that uncertainty. And our overall results, such as in the graph we have here, we ran basically a bunch of simulations, and roughly half of them, there are neighbors in the Milky Way galaxy, half not so. But in the observable universe, virtually in all cases, is there somebody out there? But we may only have one or two neighbors in our galaxy, which would make them on average tens of thousands of light years away. So perhaps it's not that unexpected that we haven't yet discovered them. But right now, is there life somewhere in the universe? Our estimates would say probably yes, but don't expect them to show up tomorrow. At this point, then, we're kind of stuck speculating about what might those aliens be like. And if they are out there and they actually can travel around the galaxy, why is it that they haven't come? Is it just too difficult? Is it the reason they don't want to come? Oh, and what if these aliens are like us and they also have their own religious traditions? We might wonder, what might religion be like with a completely different psychology and a completely different tradition, unlike anything that humans have had? And for our own religious traditions, what will happen if science can finally demonstrate that we are not alone? So the rest of this talk, I am going to be focusing on what are the likely impacts on religion, focusing largely on Christian theology, though a lot of this will also hit on theism more generally, talking about the fact that aliens don't seem to show up in the Bible, the strangeness about how particular God is with his relationship with humans, if there's a whole another universe out there to worry about, issues with the incarnation, namely when Jesus, who is supposed to also be God, comes to Earth, and how does that work with a multiplicity of other worlds, what happens with the problem of evil, and lastly, what happens with the apocalypse, and how does end-time beliefs work with when the end of the world includes more than one world? Before we get into what those various impacts are, it is worth noting that there is actually some evidence of what will happen to a religious tradition dealing with aliens based on some of the formative work in psychology from the 1950s. So the psychologist Leon Festinger had several graduate students who were able to infiltrate a UFO cult back in the mid-1950s, and this cult had a end-of-the-world doomsday belief, and they thought the end of the world would come on December 21st of 1954. You may have noticed that year has come and gone, and after that doomsday event, the question that Festinger had was, what are these religious folks going to do? And while some members left, many also remained, and they became even more fervent in their beliefs in the UFO cult. And how do they make sense of this? That clearly doomsday didn't happen. They had to find some way of reinterpreting that seemingly failed prophecy into something that wasn't failed, and then holding on to it even more strongly. So it's interesting that the idea of cognitive dissonance came from the study of UFO cults about aliens. And we will use this as a way of talking about what happens if we do discover aliens and what will be the cognitive dissonance that happens with the various religious traditions. What it also shows is that we should not expect religion to just disappear because extraterrestrial intelligence is finally discovered. But we are going to try to argue tonight there are some reasons that religion is going to have trouble explaining it, or at least many of the religious traditions are going to have issues explaining things. How about when it comes to that, we start in the beginning. So you hop over to the book of Genesis, how the universe is created according to that book. You go more generally through the Hebrew Bible, and you also look at other religious traditions related to that as well, and you find out that the imagined cosmos is not our universe. This is a world that is a flat disk with a dome built over it that is basically made of metal or steel, this thing called the firmament in English, in Hebrew, rachia, some sort of hammered out metal is what the term would suggest. And above that is the abode of God, and it's filled with the waters that the rains come from. There is no outer space. The stars are not a place that you can go and visit because the stars are attached to the dome over the earth. Aliens are not even a possibility in this cosmos. So when we are trying to fit biblical cosmology into modern cosmology, we already realize that there is not only not a resemblance between the two, one of them prohibits even the possibility of talking about extraterrestrials. There's just no place for them to go. And that cosmos that we currently have also shows something a bit strange about this original one, where the universe is created, it's small, and there's a particular group there that God has a special relationship with. All of the various religious traditions seem to highlight that humans have that special relationship, and sometimes even only a subset of those humans have an extra special relationship with the Almighty, that often a God that one is having devotion towards is very particular, very tribalistic. And this is called the problem of particularity. Why is God so particular about which people group he aligns himself with? Well, you can imagine how much bigger that problem is when we're not talking about a people group amongst folks on Earth, but a people group in a galaxy, in 100,000 galaxies, in a universe of potential infinite size, of billions of years of history and billions of years of future. This already sounds weird if we're saying basically that tiny little speck of a speck is the most important thing to the creator of all things, and doesn't even mention the existence of those other worlds or why we have that extra special relationship. It's at least strange. Can a religious person still hold to this? Sure, but all the issues of particularity when it came to a chosen people, that gets magnified once you see the magnitude of the cosmos. That big, beautiful universe that we have been exploring with telescopes now for roughly 400 years, and that we now know has other planets that could develop intelligences, now make us wonder if God has any sort of relationship with them, and if it's anything like it is, especially in the Christian tradition, how does that work there? You have to now wonder, are there alien Jesuses? And if so, how many Jesuses are out there? And this is not a facetious question that atheists have come up with. This is actually an active question in what is called astrotheology. It is the study of the Christian religion especially, but with the focus on how does this fit in the larger scheme of things. So astrotheology, basically theology of an astronomical bent on things. And this question about whether Jesus came and was the incarnation once or many times is a highly debated thing that the astrotheologians do not have a consensus on. And just to show you why they might be arguing about things, suppose that Jesus came once, and only came here to the Earth. There are potentially millions, perhaps even billions of other civilizations in existence in the universe right now. And there has potentially been millions of civilizations that have existed before us and that will exist after us. That problem for particularity has now gotten really huge. God only comes and has a special relationship with only us and has nothing to do with millions and millions of potential other advanced civilizations, some of which almost certainly more advanced, more moral than us. Again, from the Copernican principle, we are the average folk. We should not be the special ones. The problem of one incarnation basically says the Copernican principle we have to throw out. Now, you might, of course, think that maybe there's nothing wrong with that, that whatever God does here is then sufficient for the rest of the universe, and that the rest of the universe being told about that special relationship that exists here. Well, imagine the converse. Instead of Jesus coming to Earth and saving us and having taken on human flesh, what if instead Jesus went to Amphibios 9 and incarnated into a sluggo-like body? And so instead of Jesus being crucified, he was salted for your sins. Do we have the same connection with a slug being salted as we are with a human that had to have gone through its passion and death that is such a part of the story of Jesus and why his acts were supposed to be important? If you don't think that a salted slug has the same emotional impact as a person, then it's going to be the same thing probably with our potential alien brethren. If our mission is to evangelize to the universe because we've been told about this, that's also a problem because, as noted before, the universe is very, very, very big. In fact, it is so big, it is literally impossible for us to evangelize to the whole universe because there are parts of the universe accelerating away from us at faster than the speed of light. So even with our fastest message sending technology, it will never reach there. And of course, as the distance expands more and more, the signal gets weaker and weaker. So it's impossible for us to really send any sort of signal that would have been detected across the universe. And of course, this is a universe that continuously gets bigger and bigger. If our mission is to evangelize the universe, we have automatically failed from the very laws of physics. So it seems like a really strange thing if we are called to spread the word to the cosmos, if the cosmos is unreachable for the vast majority of us for the vast majority of time, or even into the indefinite future. Conversely, imagine that Jesus does come to this world, die, is resurrected, and then repeats that for every single world that requires redemption from him. And now has the idea of there being potentially trillions of Jesuses, Jesuses in other worlds in the past, Jesuses going out in the future, and potentially Jesus having to be on multiple planets at once. Again, if Jesus is basically having to incarnate across the whole universe, there's a pretty good chance that there are multiple planets at the same time that are in need of his services. So somehow Jesus needs to be not just bouncing from planet to planet, but being on multiple planets at the same time. This also sounds a whole lot like Jesus dying and coming back and then coming into another body. That sounds a whole lot like reincarnation, which is considered heretical in most Christian traditions. And also, the biblical text suggests that one incarnation is all that's needed. If Jesus has to keep dying and over again, then his death was not sufficient. In fact, in some places in the Bible, such as in Paul's letter to the Romans, it explicitly says that Jesus never does die again. His one death is sufficient. He only needed to spill his blood one time. So it becomes a very strange thing to say that he needs to do this over and over again. Can we really say Jesus conquers death if he has to keep dying over and over and over? So how does one resolve these two possibilities? Well, it seems pretty hard. And so for the most part, I look back, I see the astrotheologians arguing, eat popcorn, and wonder if they're going to come to some resolution. This problem, though, at least is being debated, because if you went back about 400 years ago, the way this argument was dealt with was very different. It literally became an issue of life and death for one person in particular. You may have heard of the heretic Giordano Bruno, an early proponent of heliocentrism, big fan of Copernicus's work. He also argued for an infinity of worlds, and that those worlds were habitable. And so in 1600 in Rome, he was put to the stake and burned alive in front of a crowd of people. Now, many people will tell you that the reasons he was killed aren't actually for scientific reasons or anything like that. But interestingly, we discovered a lot of the trial documents from the Inquisition, and we discovered those back in the 40s. And we actually see that among the things that he was being charged for being a heresy, apparently the biggest bugaboo was the declaration of the plurality of worlds. We actually have this quote from those documents that basically shows that the inquisitors were particularly struck by talking about the positing of there being many worlds with men, with people. This apparently was one of the major things that was a reason he was condemned and burned at the stake. Things have changed, obviously, a little bit, but it's interesting that we have this pre-modern Christian view that's highly against the idea that aliens are even possible, that it becomes not just scientifically implausible, but is actually a religious heresy. And we see this actually being called a heresy, not just occasionally, but by some of the greatest minds in the early modern or late medieval tradition. So you have Augustus of Hippo. He explicitly says the plurality of worlds is a heresy in a big list of heresies he wrote up. Thomas Aquinas, in his works, also says the plurality of worlds. That's a heresy. Multiple popes declared it so, including one of the popes just before Bruno was killed. We even have it in the corpus of canon law that having the opinion of innumerable worlds, that's a heresy. That's condemnable. And I have to also highlight this because many a religious person will deny this history, but the historian of science Alberto Martinez back in 2016 wrote this article basically laying out all the primary evidence and showing, no, there are dozens of examples of thinkers, Protestant and Catholic, declaring the plurality of worlds to be a heresy. Now, why is that? The reasons that seems to be the case is in part because the Bible only talks about there being one world created. We see that explicitly in Aquinas' Summa Theologica. Interestingly as well, there's also a historical reason for this, is that the plurality of worlds was an offshoot of atomism, and the idea that basically all the universe is atoms bouncing around randomly. And that was seen as tantamount to atheism, that there aren't any laws, there isn't any great lawgiver, there's no great creator putting things together. And so, well, if there's no creation, there's no creator, that sounds like atheism. And you see this explicit in Augustine, who rails against atomism, rails against atheism, and going specifically against Epicurus, who was an early atomist. And his ideas about atomism is what led him to the infinity of worlds and the possibility of them being populated. Lastly, we also see explicit statements that show, hey, this problem about the incarnation of Jesus, this doesn't make sense. There can't be more than one Jesus. There can't be multiple worlds. And while this might sound like just the theoretical idea of there being multiple worlds, this was also part of an earlier late antique debate that we see in something about what are called the antipodes. So folks who were educated in the late Greek-Roman era, they knew the world was round. The number of flat earthers is extremely small amongst educated people. But then there was this question that if the world is round and we have this continent here where, you know, that we call Europe or Africa or Asia, it seems like just by symmetry, there should also be land on the opposite side, on the opposite pole, so the anti side of the earth, where then people might be standing upside down. Now, one Christian writer like Tengtius thought that this was just impossible. The idea of people being upside down just made no sense. So this couldn't be the case. So Earth must be flat. Just totally ridiculous otherwise. Lactantius wasn't a nobody. He was actually the tutor to Constantine. So that tells you something about the education he might have been getting. Augustine, who was not a flat earther, nonetheless says no to the possibility of there being antipodes, people living on that continent on the other side of the Earth, because one, this is just mere scientific speculation. Some people might say that about aliens today, but also the idea that there's no way there could be people there because there's no way that the descendants of Adam could have gotten over there. They believe that it was basically impossible to cross the middle of the earth. It would be too hot and deadly to go that far south and get to the other side of the world. And so if the descendants of Adam aren't there, then there's no other descendants. So there's no possibility in Augustine's mind that there could be the genesis of another intelligent species. So in a sense, Christianity already went through and denied the existence of aliens, even here on Earth. There's a long tradition then of Christian theology not going well with the idea of aliens. There has been one exception that people will point to, philosopher and theologian known as Nicholas of Cusa, and he has some statements that seems like he is okay with the possibility of extraterrestrial intelligence. But like so many things, once you read him in context, that tepid possibility that he gives that God could have created worlds that intelligent creatures could be on that aren't actually angels, nonetheless, Cusa says, but we humans are the peak of the created order, that there is no intellectual nature that we are striving for beyond ourselves that's part of the created order, and that tells you there's nothing greater than us out there in the created order of things. So basically, he's denying that there are any intelligent aliens out there is even a possibility. So the only person that ever came along in before modern times that was slightly pro-alien wasn't that pro-alien. And otherwise, he was walking up to the line for what heresy was. Mind you, Nicholas is only saying that God could have created such worlds, not that he actually did. And his argument is ultimately, well, God can do whatever he wants, so we can't tell him that, no, he couldn't have created these other things. And that is all his argument. On the other hand, Bruno said, no, there actually are these other worlds. And for that, he was killed. Now, one might think, though, that the folks that have these beliefs, especially about there only being like one created world, is because of their interpretation of the Bible. And it's the case then that does God have to explain how the universe actually is and how it actually works? The idea ultimately is that God or any other supernatural entity, if he wants to be understood, now has to create a message that is understandable to the audience. When I used to teach physics at high school, I did not start instantly pulling out differential equations and showing them the Schrodinger wave equation for quantum mechanics. Why? Because my students want to understand it. Instead, I try to communicate with them the things that they do understand. I accommodate my audience, and that is just, you know, good communication practice. So if the people that God is trying to talk to can't understand a world with aliens in it, he's not going to talk about that. That seems like a fair point. However, as I noted earlier, ancient people had already been thinking about the existence of aliens, Epicurus already in the 3rd century, and this idea seemed to have such popularity that it even made it into early novels and early stories in the antique world. So this figure by the name of Lucian of Samosata, who was basically like the James Randi of his time. He also wrote this fake travel book that included people hopping aboard a ship that hit a waterspout that sent them to the moon. And then they got into a war that was going on between all the various planets. And so you have these cabbage people fighting these giant spiders that connect the various planets in the solar system together with their web. And it was a big fight between the moon people and the sun people. It's kind of crazy on purpose, but clearly the conceptual framework that there could be life out on other worlds was completely plausible in this time. And yet, at the exact same time, Christians are denying the existence of aliens because of the biblical message, that message that could have been understood if it included aliens. Remember, Christians killed because of the biblical message, and that message could have been consistent with a universe that had places for life to exist elsewhere. So this idea of accommodationism to explain why the Bible is the way it is and not including the possibility of aliens just doesn't fit. Basically, it would require the audience of God's chosen people to be less informed and less capable of other people at the exact same time. And I try not to insult people just to make my theology work. Epicurus here, I've mentioned. You also have probably heard his name because he is also famous for one of the original forms of what is called now the problem of evil. So the idea that if God is all good and all powerful, then this leads to a paradox. If God is all good, but he isn't able to prevent evil, then we shouldn't call him all powerful. If God is all powerful and doesn't prevent evil, there's no reason to call him good. If God is all good and all powerful, then why is there all this evil? Or another way of putting it, why is there such egregious suffering in the world? Now, there have been many attempts by people to come up with an explanation, something that's called a theodicy, to explain the problem of evil. And some may work better than others, but in general, this is considered, you know, one of the major problems in theology, explaining why basically bad things happen even to good people. Why is the universe terrible? Why does it include things like tsunamis and childhood cancer? These horrible things, some of them man-made, such as the Holocaust, some of them completely outside of what humans could control. And the thing is, this problem is now worse merely if aliens exist. Remember, on the Copernican principle, we are average. We're somewhere in the middle of the possibilities that exist out there. So the worst suffering that has ever happened on Earth, maybe you consider the Holocaust to be the worst thing that has ever happened in human history. Let's say that's so. If we are average in terms of the suffering that can exist amongst intelligent species in the universe, then there are species out there that have suffered things far worse than our Holocaust. Whatever the problem of evil is here, once you know that aliens exist, it actually magnifies the problem. And so this was based on a philosophy paper that was published a few years ago about aliens and the problem of evil. We actually decided to churn the math and actually solve some differential equations to see exactly how much worse the problem of evil gets if aliens exist. Just merely by existing, how much more does this become evidence against an all-good, all-powerful God? I leave the details as an appendix in the book, but basically, as far as I know, it is the only place I have seen where there is a theology book with differential equations to answer theological questions. If that's not the worth the price of admission, I don't know what it is. Of the explanations for evil out there, one of them that you might hear is that things are bad now, but when Jesus comes back and creates heaven on earth, that could solve things. All right, now then, on that solution to the problem of evil and the apocalypse that comes along with it, how does that fit with the existence of alien worlds? Because as I mentioned, we're going to be average as a civilization, and if we pop out in this universe by natural means, it's pretty likely that other civilizations have come to exist before we have. And there will be some civilizations that will come to exist far into the future. New civilizations are going to develop around other stars that are currently forming billions of years from now. And also realize that millions of years ago, if a civilization emerged, it's probably gone extinct. How does it make sense then that a civilization could have come and gone, and Jesus is supposed to somehow bring about a new heaven, a new earth for this? When is Jesus supposed to return? Is Jesus going to return to Earth? Is he going to instead return to some alien world? Does he have to return to all the alien worlds? Or is he just going to do a once and for all return to the universe, and he's outside the universe right now? When is Jesus supposed to return? Because again, we have all these other civilizations that are supposed to have their own relationship with the Almighty. And do we have to wait for those civilizations to emerge, then fall, and then need to be saved by some sort of incarnation? And this happening billions of years in the future, and so Jesus can't return until all these other civilizations have come and gone? Are we talking about Jesus coming in billions of years? Boy, does that put a lie to the phrase from the book of Revelation, "Behold, I come quickly." Religious person might say, well, a day is like 1,000 years to the Lord. Okay. 1,000 years is one thing. 1 billion. Now we have issues. And of course, the idea that there have civilizations that have actually gone extinct before Jesus' return and have caused heaven and earth to fall away. Quite the embarrassment to say that our universe will pass away and become dust for billions of years before Jesus comes quickly. This sounds absolutely absurd. And unfortunately, I have not found almost any theologian even approaching this discussion. So I found a solution for them. What if the idea of the apocalypse, of the creation of the new heaven and new earth, is limited to those worlds that Jesus comes by? So assuming there are multiple incarnations for Jesus, each one getting a Jesus, and each one getting its own end times event, its own eschaton, to use the phraseology. Now, this also would suggest that basically Jesus has to go and defeat Satan in each one of those worlds. So now, not only are there millions of Jesuses, but there's millions of Satans. I may have invented a new heresy, but I will leave that to other authorities to determine. But imagine if this is the case, then that there are worlds out there that might have already had Jesus return to them and have been transformed. So in the book of Revelation, it describes what the new heaven and new earth looks like, a place that's incorruptible, that has no need for the sun and moon for light or anything like that. If that's the case, we could use our technology to find those worlds. When it comes to finding aliens, the term is usually for technosignatures, signs of technology. What if we actually use our telescopes and find signs of theosignatures, worlds that have been transformed by end time events? That could be evidence for religion, couldn't it? So, assuming I have not committed any heresies in this proposition, we now actually have a scientific way of going out and doing these sorts of searches. I haven't had any theologians thank me for this yet. I await their emails. Now, this might, of course, sound like I'm making a little bit of fun of various religious traditions, but it's also the case that atheists might have a few things that they need to reconsider as well if the aliens show up. So what if it's the case that ET not only exists, but they arrive here? They come in their flying saucer, they land in front of the White House, they march down the gangway, and that you see they're Jesuits or Muslims or any of the religious traditions that we have here on Earth. What are the chances that on another world, completely independent of all of Earth's history and all of human psychology, the exact same religious traditions develop? The chances of that seem to be so astronomically small on naturalism, on atheism, that it has to be at least some evidence for theism. And this idea is not something original to us. Some of the early Jesuits who went to China claimed that if you read the histories of China figuratively, you can actually tell they had the entire Old and New Testament stories built into there. You just had to know how to interpret it out of there. if that really were the case, that basically the entire Christian story was in another country where no Christian missionaries had gone to, that might have been at least some evidence that wasn't actually the case. But you can imagine if E.T. shows up and they are of a very particular religious tradition that is the same as us here on Earth, it really suggests almost like there is a common religious source, and that is at least some evidence for theism, isn't it? Also, I would note, if the aliens have advanced technology and they can, say, travel across the whole galaxy and come here, you know, they probably also have advanced theology. If the aliens come and have religion, that should be at least some evidence that, hey, they have been able to think things through and come to those sorts of conclusions. Basically, Klaatu, the theologian, is probably going to be even more capable of making arguments that are convincing than earthly theologians or apologists like William Lane Craig. So if Klaatu does come and he is religious and a philosopher, I think just by that, just kind of an argument from authority, you might say, provides some evidence for theism. And for those of you who have not watched the original, The Day the Earth Stood Still, Klaatu is Jesus. I can talk about the details of that movie later, but in quite reality, he's basically a Jesus analog. So if Klaatu Jesus showed up, that should at least be some evidence for Christianity, shouldn't it? But even if the aliens don't have religion, it could become a religion for us. We have a few examples in relatively recent history that have good documentation that shows what happens when a civilization comes along with advanced technology and how the locals then react to that. So, for example, when Captain Cook first arrived at Hawaii, and the particular timing and the particular way that Cook's ship was circling the island before finally landing, this was seen in a very particular lens by the locals there, that they basically thought of him as some sort of god. There are various cargo cults active today in Micronesia, and one of them still worships Prince Philip as a god. This religion developed sometime in the 50s, 60s, and they basically figured that Prince Philip was actually related to another figure known as John Frum, who was also basically an American as a god. John Frum is like John from America. There were other ones like Tom Navy. There was a figure known as Roosevelt, President Theodore or President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, treated as gods in these cultures. So we have some examples of cults revolving around humans because in part the advanced technology and the advanced things that they brought along. So we see that somewhat in human history. We also see the various cults around aliens today, and the UFOs haven't even actually shown up and religious traditions have shown up. You could only imagine what would happen if aliens really were detectable, what would happen to those kinds of religions. And how strong that event might happen is going to probably depend on the sort of scenario we are looking at. If the aliens are very far away and we can just sense them remotely, we pick up a radio signal, we see the heat signatures from some of their massive structures around stars, things like that, that suggest they're out there, but very far away, that probably won't have as big an impact as close encounters. Again, the idea if the aliens land on Earth and are literally walking around on the lawn in front of the White House, that is going to probably have a bigger impact than the remote detection. But even so, there's a pretty good chance that E.T. could be seen as a deity of some sort, and maybe deservedly so. I ran some calculations to say that, hey, if aliens could actually get here on some sort of spacecraft, and they could do that at some significant fraction of the speed of light, the energy levels of their civilization would be so great, they would be on the order of natural forces. And considering humans considered natural forces to be gods, it would only be fair to then consider these creatures to also be gods if they wield the energy of thunderstorms and earthquakes. If they come with the energy of Thor, maybe we should call them Thor, for example. There's also one other thing that's a little bit different than religion itself, but also what is the longevity of humanity itself? What might it mean to us, religious or not, if we did discover the mere fact that they are out there? I want to return to something that I glossed over with the Drake equation. Now, several of the numbers on here are fairly well constrained, and some of these numbers are not well known, but they have a maximum value. So, for example, the fraction of habitable worlds that can have life on it, that fraction can only be between 0 and 1. It really tells us that even if we maxed out those unknown values, such as the fraction of worlds with life, the fraction of living worlds with intelligence, and the fractions of worlds that can communicate with the stars, with radio technology, for example, even if those are all set to 1, the number of civilizations in the galaxy is small unless the lifetime of those civilizations is large. And that is the interesting thing, is our current projection from the earlier work that I suggested from our simulation is that maybe there's 1 or 2 civilizations in the Milky Way right now, which means they're also so far away that it's no wonder we haven't detected them. If we haven't detected them, well, that could be either they don't exist or they're stupendously far away. If conversely, we did detect them, that means they would have to be close by. We don't have the ability to see if there's a civilization on the opposite side of the Milky Way. And if they're close to us, the only way that becomes probable is if they're numerous. And the only way that they can be numerous is if they're long-lived. Why is this important? If we return to the Copernican principle, we're most likely going to just be an average civilization. And if we just discover a single radio source out among the stars that says somebody is there, that tells us what is then the average lifespan of a civilization. And then if we are average, our civilization isn't expected to last decades or centuries. More likely, our civilization will be around for thousands or tens of thousands or even more years. The Copernican principle, combined with just one faint detection from the stars, can say that we have a long and glorious future ahead of us as humans. And if that's not a reason to fund SETI, I don't know what is. Because knowing that we are not alone not only helps fill out the universe, but tells us that we have a beautiful future. We have our problems right now. We have our worries. But if they out there can make it, so can we. Even if we are just the C students of the Milky Way, we can be C students with a long, beautiful future. This and more is part of the discussion in the book that my co-author and I wrote. This is the cover for that, and you can scan the QR code if you want to go to the Amazon page. This was an absolute pleasure to write in the first place with Jonathan Pierce, and Jonathan also has many, many other books that also are probably of interest to fellow skeptics here. So strong double reason to check this out. And otherwise, I thank you for your time and your attention, and I hope to hear some really good questions in Q&A time. But otherwise, thank you, and let's take a nice break and talk more aliens after. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Aaron. It's amazing how interesting it can become if you take a potential idea and combine it with another potential idea, and then you talk about it for almost an hour. Very good. Thank you. Hello, welcome back. Well, you've used your time well. We've got plenty of interesting questions to review. Before we start that, I just want to remind everybody that our online pub will start after this talk is finished. The Login's Razor, and as always, your quest to find access to it will start at our website, sidp.online. This time, it's /virtual pub, one word. Good, let's talk about the questions. And I think I would like to start with the question from Possibly Aliens. I wouldn't call it a question, more a command. He says, she says, they say, human, show us your pet. We require images of small animals. Well, Aaron has got a cat, but unfortunately it will not be possible to get her in front of the camera, especially as the cat seems to have a self-image problem and doesn't like seeing other cats on the screen, from what Aaron told us. So we will definitely not be able to do that. But let's go back to the talk and the talk subject. And I think we're starting with a relatively critical question from Andrew. And I mean, let's address the elephant in the room first. Andrew says, that was interesting, but given we can't prove God even exists, why is this worth thinking about? He apologizes for supposedly blunt language. I don't see it like that, but he's asking respectfully, and that's nice to know. So, Aaron.
Yeah, it's definitely a valid question because, yeah, if you're an atheist, then obviously you don't have any theological problems necessarily. Though I did try to throw in the caveat that if the aliens show up and they're religious, that might actually at least add some weight to the idea that religion or a very particular religion is true. If the aliens have advanced technology, they probably have advanced theology. We should at least pay attention to them. If they can travel light years, they know a thing or two. That's worth listening to. But even so, the question still becomes, people actually do believe these various religious traditions now, and they're going to probably believe that for a very, very long time. And it is a curiosity then of what might be predict to be the problems they might have, what might be the things that they are resistant to, and also maybe try to predict how they will attempt to reconcile these sorts of things. And if your purpose is also to be an anti-theist, what sorts of arguments would you want to then throw in that person's face? I presented, like, for example, the original biblical cosmos that has a sky dome. Even groups like Answers in Genesis, one of the major young earth creationist organizations out there, completely denies that the Bible says that the earth is flat and there's a sky dome like that, because that would be silly. But that's what a literal reading of the Holy Book would suggest. So in some ways, this is worthwhile bringing up because all these attempts to try to modernize the belief system shows just how much it has to come kicking and screaming. The idea of aliens in particular isn't just that, well, they have these other traditions and so they just couldn't understand. This is an interesting example because there were traditions that aliens were out there and there was an explicit rejection of that. And that becomes interesting and I think an interesting part of how we're going to have these dialogues in the future and how heated those dialogues will get if we do finally prove ET is out there.
Yeah. I'll dig in at that point, and just out of interest, you're obviously comparing this a lot to a Christian Western background. That's where you also have grown up. Now, what would have most Christian churches have more of a problem with? The aliens show up and they're all Jesuits, or the aliens show up and they're all Buddhists?
Well, obviously, if Jesuits from space showed up, there would be a bit of consternation amongst the Baptists, but that would be small potatoes compared to they come and they are in a completely different tradition and have nothing to do with the Abrahamic faiths. I would also, though, imagine that part of the way that we'll try to get around that is the suggestion that they're actually demons. This is actually something that there are a fair number of Christians who will argue that the aliens that people claim they're seeing now, that the UFO phenomenon, is actually demonic consternations. These are demons flying around and doing that. And from what I've researched as well, part of our book was also to look not just at the Christian tradition, but also in Eastern religious traditions, in Islam, and amongst Islamic folks, that there's also the belief in UFOs, but the argument that they're being driven by demons, or even more specifically by jinn. So the alien demon connection is already made by many groups to try to then, I guess, deal with it when ET shows up. And if they are up to no good, then they're going to be called alien, or they're going to be called demons. On the other hand, I guess if the aliens show up and they give us all sorts of beneficial technology, well, that'll be an interesting thing. If the aliens can make heaven on Earth, then we're not going to start wanting heaven out there. That'll also have an effect on religion, to say the least.
Let's hope Sluggo comes in peace.
Yeah.
Okay.
It depends on what books they bring. If they bring the book that says to serve man, that's when we need to be worried.
Okay. Good. Dave asked the question. with the Drake equations, aren't some of the unknowns so unknown that any outputs are actually irrelevant?
It's true that, yes, some of those factors, we can't say we have any evidence to work with that. So how do you build a statistic with no data? There are probability distributions that you can actually use when you have no data. So in particular, we use something called the Jeffries prior. And this is a way of saying you have a completely uninformative background information to help you decide what the probability is. And when it comes to the fraction ones, so like such as the fraction of habitable worlds that become life-bearing, the Jeffries prior for that basically says it's either very likely that these worlds don't develop life or very likely that they do. And the probability of it being 50-50 is actually the lowest. It's the probability of the probability is quite low, interestingly, for that. So we use these uninformative prior probability distributions to use in our sampling. So we're basically saying, hey, yes, we absolutely are ignorant about this, but we can model that ignorance.
That's a beautiful sentence. We can model ignorance. That's good. Paul asked a question. If evidence for ETI was conclusively discovered, would religions die out as a result, or would they simply incorporate the new evidence into their beliefs?
So it's going to probably depend a lot on the particular traditions. So, for example, the UFO cults, they already believe in aliens. So if the aliens show up, they're going to start shouting, "We told you so. We told you so." They're going to have people flocking to their congregations, while the traditional religious groups will have more trouble. Though, interestingly, the Mormons will probably be okay. In the early works of like Joseph Smith and the early Mormons, they were totally pro-alien. And effectively, God is an alien. That religious tradition would probably be safe. But I doubt religion will completely die out. That was the idea of people like Arthur C. Clarke in his book, Childhood's End. The aliens show up and religion basically keels over and dies. That's, I think, optimistic on the part of Clarke, that we'll just become completely rationalistic once we see the aliens are here. By the way, the novel itself is still worth reading. There are a few things about it that Clarke himself didn't like, including he incorporated like psychic abilities that he now realized that was bogus. But in the 50s, that apparently was considered more legit. But nonetheless, very interesting book. And especially when the aliens show up and they look like the devil, how do people react to that? all sorts of issues that exist there. But most importantly, from what we've seen on the research on cognitive dissonance, expect most religious traditions to adapt and not just fall over. They'll find some sorts of apologetic or excuse for it. And I mean, heck, we already have young Earth creationists who just deny the entirety of radiometric dating for knowing how old the Earth is. And if they can deny like the age of rocks, then they're going to deny radio signals came from little green men.
Okay. Along the same lines, actually, comes Igor's question. Do you think humanity will always be religious, or do you envision a time where we can just accept the reality and be okay with it?
I have of mixed thoughts about this. There is the evidence that when living conditions of people improve, they tend to become more and more secular. On the other hand, there are things kind of like built into human psychology that creates the idea of there being intelligences of a more supernatural nature out there. So, for example, our hyperactive agency detection. If you're in the woods and you hear a snapping twig, the first thing you shout is, "Who's there?" That we tend to project minds out outside of ourselves very naturally. And I don't think we're getting over that just because we have good living conditions. Religion will perhaps become less and less of a powerful force in life and in politics. That might be the case, but I doubt that we're going to become 10 billion atheists in the future.
Okay. Good. We'll now have several questions, apparently, which will deal with the subject of artificial intelligence. We'll kick off with Igor again. What if instead of encountering aliens, we suddenly invent a strong AI? Would this change anything from any perspective?
In some ways, it could be the case that the first aliens we meet are the ones we happen to build. now, My worry, though, is that so much of what is there with the science fiction of aliens is that these creatures have completely different minds from us. They have a completely different evolution for how their minds develop, so we can't expect them to have the same psychological features as humans. But if, for example, our artificial intelligence is made by humans using human data, what we're going to ultimately be running into isn't necessarily a new different kind of mind, but the sum total of Reddit posts. And that may not have the same alienness that a completely different species on another planet might have. Conversely, though, I do think there could be interesting theological questions because, well, do computers that seem intelligent have souls? To some degree, this is something even Alan Turing was considering when he came up with the Turing test, and the idea of ensoulment being a an issue that he had to overcome with his criteria for determining if a computer is actually intelligent or not. At the very least, it seems like if we can, in silicon, build intelligence, that's going to mess with our ideas of how souls work and if computers need salvation. Do we need computer Jesus, and does he have to suffer computer viruses? Perhaps take a lot of the thesis tonight and make some adjustments, but I think the existence of aliens will be an even more strong hit against traditional religion than AI. But that is to be determined.
Again, stepping aside from the questions for a moment, we are currently discussing meetings or contact with physical biological beings quite often. What about if our first contact with another civilization are von Neumann machines? Machines that get just sent out to replicate and search, basically.
Yeah, and I think that is more probable than that the aliens themselves show up. In order of what we're likely to actually have come our way is distant remote signs of their intelligence, whether it's radio transmissions from them or the heat exhaustion from their megastructures, things like that, that we can detect with our telescopes, for example. That's the easiest thing to travel across the galaxy. And so that's what we most likely see first. Second would be something like a probe, because it's much easier to send machines out into space rather than biological entities that need food, water, and tend to complain about being stuck in a tube for tens of thousands of years. So that would be my order of thought. The vague remote signatures of intelligence, machines sent by those civilizations, and then the biological creatures that create that technology. That'd be the order of likeliness of what we would see.
Okay. Let's go back to questions. I don't want to hog the whole conversation. Anonymous is asking a question. Is it likely that super AI on Earth, our local aliens, will develop a religion that we can identify?
That is hard to know because, well, the thing is, the reason we have religion is a really complex collection of human psychology and historical accident. In fact, one of the books I have back here somewhere behind me is a book called Before Religion that basically argues that religion, as we understand it, is really a modern Western European concept that was imported and kind of forced upon understanding the rest of the world and its alleged religious traditions. That it's more of a historic thing rather than like a obvious human universal. So there's a few ways we might step back with this. So one is, will computers have beliefs in supernatural entities? That is hard to know, in part because if the computers basically build up their worldview by the summation of what humans believe, then they probably would. If, on the other hand, we believe that they're just these cold calculating machines and we think the evidence points against the existence of God, then they're going to come to that conclusion because they don't have any other motivation other than coldly, you know, working out the numbers and saying, yeah, the probability of God is too low to credit. As for the other aspect of religion, when it comes to traditions, practices, things like that, really hard to know if computers would ever develop anything like ritual. I don't see any necessary reason why they might. But on the other hand, we haven't developed that technology yet, so it's hard to predict exactly what it will look like once it's finally in front of us. So I'm very agnostic about where that might go.
There's almost more in variables than in the Drake quest thing. So yeah, one more AI, or are we changing subject now? Again, Igor is asking, do you think the religion is an inevitable byproduct of sentience, or will the concept of religion be alien to visiting aliens?
My guess is that we should expect at least as much diversity in alien psychology as there is amongst humans. And so you see some humans who are hyper-religious. They basically see supernatural things behind every corner. And there are some people on the opposite end of that spectrum and have no like strong theory of mind, and they just don't have any sense of supernatural entities out there. And if there's that much diversity within humans who all have the same basic brain structure and the same evolutionary history, a completely different species doesn't have those limitations, expected to be at least as diverse. So my guess is if there are intelligent aliens out there, some of them will be more religious than humans on average, some of them less. There might be worlds out there that are extremely vehemently and aggressively religious, and other groups that just don't even have the concept of a mind without a body. That they're all completely atheists, and they just don't even have that concept in their vocabulary. And of course, when it comes to that diversity of religious beliefs, we also might worry that if they are evangelical about their beliefs, are they also doing that in an aggressive way? Are they going to come out and basically try to convince us with argumentation, or are they going to be conquistadors with laser weapons? And we have a fair bit of sci-fi about that as well. If you're familiar with the American show, The Orville, I'm forgetting which species in there now, has a very aggressive religious position, and they want to destroy the humans because of that. And there's a similar thing in the Halo video game series. We have at least that idea, and yeah, there's probably some religious Klingons out there.
Nicely put. Good. Another question from Anonymous. Are any ideas in theology potentially convergent, so aliens could develop them independently without evidence of divinity? Perhaps this has happened on Earth.
So the arguments that might exist for the existence of God, such as arguments about causality, the cosmological argument, that sort of thing. I could imagine another intelligent civilization having the same kinds of arguments about, well, what came before that? Where did everything come from? And having those sorts of thoughts and then attributing it to a god or having arguments to that end. Arguments like fine-tuning or basically all the arguments about how life had to have been created before Darwin came along and showed why that was kind of rubbish. I can easily believe that those things could independently develop on other worlds that had completely different religious histories. But when it comes to the particulars of a theological system, I think those are extremely contingent on the history of things. One of the examples that we give in our book is how some of the weird contingencies of where the stars were 10,000 years ago created religious traditions or myths that then got passed around, that then evolved and then became stories in the Iliad and Odyssey of Homer that then were adapted into the Gospel of Mark that then becomes part of Christian tradition. So you can like watch this evolution of ideas of what some hunter-gatherers were talking about or imagining 10, 20,000 years ago, those ideas developing by random reasons, then being adjusted by some Greek poets, and then several centuries later, somebody else trying to riff on those stories, entering into a religious tradition. And you can see just every single domino in that could have easily fallen in a different way. And that's just for like one story. So in particular, the story of the Gerasene demoniac, the person who is like filled full of demons so much so that he says he is legion, for he is many. He's just that full of demons. And Jesus then comes along and, you know, kicks the demons out of him and they go into pigs. The Bible scholar Dennis MacDonald, I think, has persuasively argued that this is actually based on the story of Polyphemus from the Odyssey about this giant creature Cyclops, whose name Polyphemus means many-voiced, like the many voices of the demons. And there's also the story of the troops with Odysseus being turned into pigs by Circe. There's these interesting connections that MacDonald puts together. And it's like, okay, the author of the Gospel of Mark is riffing off and trying to emulate these stories from Homer, who was basically the Bible person for the ancient Greeks. That's like a weak equivalent. But in that case, then, of course, where does the idea of the Cyclops come from? Part of that actually comes from the accidental discovery of elephant bones. If you look at an elephant skull and you've never seen an elephant, there, where the hole where the trunk is, looks like a giant eye in the middle of your forehead. And this is very plausibly where the idea of the Cyclops comes from. So an accident of where some elephant bones were found leads to this tradition, which then becomes a story in Homer, which then becomes something emulated in the Gospel of Mark, which then, well, becomes part of the canon of a major world religion.
Mm. Wow. Okay. A question from Igor. Do you think religions of today will evolve into accepting aliens and their many Jesuses?
Mm. I think some, yes, because some astrotheologians already have said that, yeah, that's something we can accept. And in fact, there's a Jesuit by the name of Brother Guy. His name is Italian, so I'm going to totally butcher it. Cosmo Leogono. I know I'm saying it wrong, but Brother Guy. And even though his name is Italian, he's actually originally from Detroit. So he's totally American sounding, but his name is Italian. Anyways, he wrote a book called Would You Baptize an Alien? And kind of sort of basically says if they have the desire to join the mother church, that he would happily then provide the sacraments for them to join up. So clearly some theologians totally on board. On the other hand, you talk to people who are like at the heads of Answers in Genesis, and they deny the existence of aliens completely. So they would probably say if the aliens did show up, they're more likely to call them demons rather than people to evangelize to.
So they don't have to answer the question, basically, because it doesn't come up.
Yeah.
Okay. We've got a question from Serdar now. If religious majority were aware of implications, do you think all ETI research would stop?
So, fortunately, even in the United States, young Earth creationist beliefs is the minority. So, on that front, I wouldn't necessarily say that that would happen. It's really hard to know, because there is one thing that is definitely true about religion and religious traditions, and it can be summed up in one word: diversity. I have little expectation that I could talk so broadly about what would happen with a religious majority funding or not funding a certain thing. I can imagine religious people saying we ought to fund this sort of research because then we can know just how grand God's creation is. And then others will say, no, this is going to cause huge theological problems. I suspect it would get slow walked, that there would be slow acceptance of doing this sort of research and making it easier to accept when we do have the evidence, and when the evidence comes, make it nice and slow, so that way it doesn't hit hard. Basically, if we can slowly walk into the idea of aliens rather than them just straight up showing up, we'll have a dramatically different effect on the history, or sorry, on the future development of religious traditions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now something that I was thinking of several times during your talk. Not yet, in a moment. Okay, the question, Anonymous asks, given lots about religious scripture is simply ignored, such as the dome earth you mentioned, do you not think the same will just be done for these issues?
Oh, certainly, because that is just a truth of religious traditions, that no one who claims to take the Bible literally, for example, actually takes the Bible literally, because the Bible doesn't speak with one unified, clear voice. It has a multitude of people within it talking around and against each other, and to try to reconcile that all together into some sort of consistent theology requires basically negotiating parts against each other. This can't mean this because it contradicts this other view or this other dogma or this other statement elsewhere, and you have to find whatever excuse it is to make everything kind of fit together. So almost certainly that people will find ways to argue around why this declaration or this verse won't be the problem that we currently perceive it. Just like you say, yeah, most religious folks will try to find some reason that the earth is described as flat with a dome isn't actually what the Bible is really trying to say. there's the accommodation view that they just, this was the view of the Egyptians and the Babylonians and other Canaanite groups and that. So when God was sending his message, he had to fit that cosmology so that way they could understand. That is the common way of trying to understand what's going on there. Of course, as I've tried to argue, that that doesn't fully alleviate the problem. And, you know, it's also the case that even when you are accommodating your message, you don't have to accommodate it with lies. I try to accommodate my message to students when I'm teaching high schoolers, for example, but I don't tell them that electrons are alive thinking creatures and that you have to treat them well, just so that becomes a little bit easier for them to understand why electricity flows through wires. There's accommodating, there's simplifying, and then there's just making things up or just lying to people just to make things easier. The fact of the matter is, if God has to basically explain the universe like my parents or like our parents had to explain sex with the stork theory, that's just not an acceptable accommodation. But religious people will nonetheless find a way to make it work or claim it works.
Yeah, true. A few more questions around detecting aliens or encountering aliens. A question from Anonymous again. How much remote alien detection is needed to confirm their existence and to unsettle religion? Is two-way communication or their presence enough?
Ooh. Well, in particular, when it comes to two-way communication, that might be unfeasible because of the distances involved. If we discover another civilization a mere 100 light years away, then they sent their signal out a century ago when we finally detected it. And if we send it back to them with some sort of reply, it's 100 years to get there, and then we'd have to wait at least a century for them to reply back. And the idea of waiting 200 years to get a reply to your text, if we send a communication out of the universe saying, you up, and we have to wait 200 years to get any of response to that, it's pretty rough. How much evidence is it going to take? It's really going to depend on the quality of that evidence. If we are able to show that the signal is one, definitely not from Earth, from any terrestrial source, and it really shows clear signs of artificiality, there's no other astronomical phenomena that we can find that can otherwise explain it, that will at least be some evidence, but I will still want to say, hey, that's one detection, that's a wonderful anecdote, but I would like, you know, several detections to really feel confident. But at the very least, if we got a what is called a narrow band signal from outer space that isn't from a human source, that should at least make us add evidence that aliens are out there, even if it's not 100% confirmation.
Okay, but there's also another aspect to it. Those kind of signals would be received, decoded, interpreted by specialists first. And to quote a famous saying from the UK, people are fed up with specialists. So... would that be good enough? Would the general population believe that?
That's a good question.
Or is it just a question of a good marketing strategy?
You know, that question, or like how to answer that question, would probably change from year to year. Let's put it this way. Let's say it's January 2020, and you were asking me about how well would people accept advice about how to deal with a novel coronavirus. I would not have predicted what happened in the months after January 2020. So knowing that failure on my part to predict, I am reluctant to make further predictions about how much people would accept the scientific evidence for clear signals out there. Now, some people will easily accept it because some people already believe the aliens are here. And then they'll just say the scientists are now finally revealing the truth that they've known all along. And of course, others will find any excuse to deny it totally. Expect diversity, but what's the average person going to do? That, I think, is kind of hard to know.
Okay. Good. Next question from Garnet. Considering the enormity of space and the time it would take to receive signed signals, you already talked about that, of alien life, how long or how would young Earth creationists reconcile the detection of, I guess?
They would probably have to basically incorporate it into some of their current ways to explain why they can see galaxies a billion light years away. So, for example, that God could have made light in transit, to make it look like it's coming from very far away. So I guess God could also create alien signals in transit to make it look like they're very, very far away.
I mean, he already put the dinosaur bones there.
Yes, so. Yes. Yeah, it would most likely have to just be a slight tweak to the excuses for how they already explained starlight. Yeah, that'd be my guess of how they would deal with that.
Good. Now we're approaching the behavioral guides of type of questions. So Anonymous asks, do aliens who view humans, Earth, and our religious ideas as dangerous and to be avoided have any theological implications on our side, I guess the question means?
Oh, so basically we're infected with religion and the aliens are staying away from us because of that.
Yeah. How would we ever know?
Yeah, well, the thing is, one of the issues we bring up in the book with ideas, so this is something part of what's often called the zoo hypothesis, the idea that the aliens are out there, but they don't interact with us, and they're basically just observing us, just like if we go to the zoo and we're observing animals there. But as you might know, with humans are stupid. And occasionally, some humans decide it's a smart idea to jump over the fence and play with the lions. And if you combine that with young age and alcohol, things like that are almost expected to happen. So a problem we put in our book, we call it the teenager problem. If there's like these advanced civilizations out there surrounding us in the galaxy, they probably got teenagers, and you tell them to do something, and that's exactly the thing that they will not do. So just we might expect occasionally space benders from aliens, you know, crashing their car, you know, their mom's van here on Earth and causing trouble here. Just accidents will happen if the galaxy is just full of life, and these, you know, accidents can potentially happen. To make it so that the entire galaxy is perfectly policed to make sure nobody accidentally comes here is very, very difficult to do. And basically it requires a lot of hypothesizing with no evidence. So it's one of the reasons we have issues with the zoo hypothesis generally.
It could explain a lot of anal probing. Okay, next question. I apologize. The Copernican principle. Anonymous says, you keep returning to the Copernican principle. Do religious people tend to believe in this principle? She doesn't see why they should. That's also a thought I had, because you interpret it as kind of the formula that describes our mediocrity to show where we are, or the principle. A lot of humans and religious people like to think of themselves as exceptional. So how well accepted is that view?
Well, it may not be totally accepted, but on the other hand, it is in some ways a perfect result from statistical reasoning. I mean, indeed, if you ask people, 80% of people say that they're better than average at driving, which, as you instantly realize, is impossible. 80% of people can't be above that average point. That's the thing. But the point with the Copernican principle is actually derived from statistical reasoning, that if you have something that you can measure, those measurements will most likely then follow what's called a normal distribution or bell curve. And most of the measurements are close to the average value. And as you get further and further away from the average, it becomes rarer and rarer. And that's this. And to say that those things out there are rarer and rarer is to say they're also exceptional and they're low probability. Where is it most probable? Being close to the middle. So just from that statistical reasoning, unless you have evidence otherwise, you should expect to be closer to average than exceptional, because there are fewer exceptions than there are average normal folks. So to deny that means you either need evidence of it, or you are just denying pure mathematics in a way. Now, I know what might be a response is that based on one's religious tradition, they say, well, according to this, humans are special. Humans were made separate and special from the rest of the animal kingdom. And then they'll just extend that to that the Earth was made special in that sense. Fact of the matter is, though, is that those books just don't even talk about the possibility of other worlds. So you really can't use that silence to then say that nothing else is out there, because that book denied the very existence about the very thing what we're now talking about.
Okay. Good. Nadia asks, what's your favorite eschatological myth? And what's your favorite scientific theory of the end of the universe?
Ooh, so the eschatology that we find in Norse mythology is probably the most interesting and action-packed version of Ragnarok. Though exactly how Ragnarok works is a little bit confusing, because our sources for it actually were Christian monks. So there are, at the very least, add-ons to the older myths. So what was the form before Christians came along and started altering it? I don't know enough there. But the idea basically of this true final battle of Thor fighting, what is it, Jotunheimr, the giant world serpent, and Odin being killed by Fenrir the wolf, and all that wonderful final destruction, is at least a bit more action-packed and interesting, and has become a really good video game if you've played the more recent God of War games. though that end of the world could also get even more interesting. In the early 80s, in the Thor comic book series, it actually shows that Ragnarok is actually itself cyclical. There have been many Ragnaroks, and then Asgard had been rebuilt over and over again as Odin just kind of like reconstitutes himself after Ragnarok. So a modification of the myth, if you prefer. Now, as for the real world outside of Marvel Comics, right now, the evidence most suggests that the way the universe is going to end is not with a bang, but with a whimper, with the heat death of the universe. As the universe continues to expand more and more, and the fuel for the stars gets used up more and more, and as enough time goes by, even the black holes that currently are feeding or just sitting quietly will slowly evaporate away from Hawking radiation. And so in trillion, 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 trillion years from now, that we may not even have black holes, and the universe will then just become cold and desolate, and you will have almost not even fluctuations in the gas and dust remaining around there. And that assumes also that protons don't decay. It's still an open question if protons will decay, and then you won't even have dust. So our future will be so cold and so dead that time won't even have meaning. And that might be our most likely future for this universe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If Jesus waits too long, there might not be much to resurrect. Good. Anonymous asks if any of the ideas you explain tonight can be used for a sci-fi novel. He would like to borrow some of you.
Absolutely. in our book itself, we do mention several lines of science fiction that intersect with this. I try to make as many hidden Star Trek references as I possibly can. A few of them I got under my co-author's nose. He didn't realize what I was doing. And we make a lot of reference to probably one of the great masters of science fiction, Arthur C. Clarke. He has some really potent stories about how to incorporate religious beliefs and these discoveries about the alien worlds. And very often, more often than not, there's a problem that happens because of the aliens existing and what that does to religion. I'll particularly note it's the 1953 or is it 54 short story that Clark wrote called The Star. And it has a Jesuit astrophysicist going to the remnants of a supernova. I forget how many thousands of light years away. He's exploring that and discovering that at the outer edges of this remnant, there is a planet with a giant vault there that an ancient civilization built. And that civilization built this vault to basically preserve their civilization. They knew their star was going to go nova and destroy them. And they tried to save some remnant of that in this world. And the archaeologists go there, discover that, this was a wonderful, peaceful world with advanced art and technology and had high moral standards and all these things. And then the Jesuit works out exactly when the star exploded and then calculates when the star went off and then when the light of that star would have gotten to Earth, and realized that this exploding star was the Star of Bethlehem. And then the story ends with the Jesuit basically having this crisis of faith, saying, you know, like, God Almighty, why did you destroy this peaceful world just to light up the sky over a small town? Why did you commit this wonderful civilization to the fire? And this won a Nebula Award for short story because of its, it's a good story. So,
a convoluted version of the end of Planet of the Apes.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. And I mentioned a few other stories in here that also, you know, try to connect a little bit of Jesus and the stars. Conversely, I should also mention some stories that are more pro-religion and aliens. And there's a trilogy of books by C.S. Lewis where basically aliens live on Mars, aliens live on Venus. And interestingly, the Venusians never had a fall from grace. They never had the Adam and Eve sin problem. So they basically want the humans to go away and stop bothering them because the humans are the one coming along and bringing sin into the world. So there's some stuff there. And I also then have to recommend one other book that it's before Clark's Great Works, and C.S. Lewis hated it. It's Star Maker. And it has the earliest version of the Dyson sphere concept, the idea of basically building a sphere around a star and collecting all of its light. But basically, there is this great cosmic force that's just constantly creating universes and life on them, creates heavens and hells, creates universes with more and less spatial dimensions. It's really weird and out there. It's almost like combining science fiction and the Book of Revelation in the way it's kind of written. And C.S. Lewis said that this was pure, like pure paganism or pure Gnosticism. It was totally heretical to him. So another reason to read that book.
Okay, I'll look it up. I think we've got one last question. And this one is deep, so prepare yourself. Nadia wants to know, is Jesus a particle or a wave?
So there's a few different ways we can interpret this. We could go with the Copenhagen Jesus interpretations and suggest that Jesus is a wave until you observe him, and then he collapses into a particle. Which would, I guess, potentially mean that on Holy Saturday, when Jesus was in the tomb, he was still a wave and he was in a state of being dead and alive at the same time until the stone was finally opened on Sunday. That's one possible interpretation. Or we could take the many worlds interpretation and that all possible Jesus states exist at the same time. So there is a great plethora of Jesuses all entangled with himself until observed, and then those entangled states disentangle. What can I say? Quantum mechanics is already weird. And when you add Jesus to it, it gets even more special and weird.
Okay. I've just been convinced that we have one more question additionally. Okay. Karen Tankeras asks, you say finding aliens could indicate that we will have a long, beautiful existence. Where's the evidence that we will live long, that if we live long, we will also prosper?
So, if we are detecting those alien civilizations, they must have a level of technological prowess great enough for us to even detect with our technology. And just, again, from that Copernican principle, if they've been able to stick around for a long time and achieve such high levels of ability, then we should expect to also, in our future, have similar achievements. And I guess maybe it's me being a bit of an optimist that as we further develop technology that we're going to have better and better lives because of it. And indeed, as we develop technology, we create problems, but with that technology, we also create the solutions. Sure, when we first figured out how to generate electricity from coal-fired plants, we now have all the issues of pollution and global warming, but we also can develop solutions to those problems with more advanced technology and other energy sources. Basically, I say we keep funding science because that's the way that we're going to make the world better. Because of that, I think that if aliens can achieve even more advanced technology than us, imagining that we had that same ability, we could also make our lives better, and that would be our potential glorious future.
Okay. Since we've run out of questions, I got one more to add at that point. You mentioned before that quote from the Bible, Jesus will come quickly. Mm. Over the years, a lot of Christian people have told me about humor in the Bible, like, for example, the tower at Babel that they built as high as they could and God came down from where he is and had a look at it. and that he came down is supposed to be a reference to humor. Maybe Jesus coming quickly is also kind of humorous reference to, oh, it's going to take some time.
The problem is, if it was a joke, then the early Christians weren't in on it. For example, in the writings, the authentic writings of the Apostle Paul, he thinks Jesus is coming, and he thinks he's coming so soon, it's not even worth having kids. Don't even get married, don't have sex at all. There's nothing worthwhile. And the only reason you should get married is if you just have urges and you just can't handle it, get married so you can at least, in a prophylactic way, deal with those problems. But don't actively try to have a large family in that, because Jesus is coming soon and there's nothing else to worry about with that. Prepare for the time to come. Paul talks about being alive when Jesus comes and greeting him when he comes down in the clouds. And the author of the book of Revelation, who, by the way, if you read that book, the one thing you will not do is read that and think this person has a sense of humor.
Okay. Good. Well, I think that's it. Once again, thank you very much for a really intriguing and fascinating evening. I hope our audience enjoyed it as much as I did. But I'm sure there'll be lots of clapping in our Twitch chat now. Again, thank you very much for taking the time. Before I say goodbye, I also want to thank our technical team in the background. Igor and Matty were handling that. And I had Dave answering or preparing the questions in the order in which to be asked and standing in case I get taken away by an internet outage. Who knows? So thank you very much, Igor, Matty, and Dave. And to the rest of you, as usual, stay safe, stay healthy, stay skeptical. Have a good night.
That was the Skeptics in the Pub online podcast. For more skeptical content, including information about future talks, please like us on Facebook, follow at SITP on Twitter, or head to our website at sitp.online, where you'll also find a link to all the ways you can get in touch with us, including our Discord server. Music in this episode was provided by Thula Bora and used with permission. Until next time, thanks for listening.